Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And today we are discussing Black faith in America.
Yes, we are discussing Black faith in America, mainstay of our presence in this here country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We got a lot with us.
Yeah, on the faith front. We do.
Got a lot of looks, different faces. So we are going to kind of delve into this. I don't know what this looks like. May or may not be a series like our Faith Story series or our Sex in the Bible series, mm-hmm. which neither of which are done. we're still working through those. We should have a Faith Stories episode next week. Mm-hmm. We got a special guest coming in. But this week, we're talking Black faith in America.
Yes.
And the different forms that it's taken.
Yeah. So this is a worthy topic, and keep in mind we're saying Black faith in America, not necessarily Black Christianity. So right. To me, this appears to be like a puzzle. We're going to put this attempt to define these puzzle pieces and put it together so that there's just an understanding. I think that there's this idea that, I don't know, that it starts with Black churches, or that even that, you know, Black faith in America is undeniably Christian rooted and thereby affected, sanctioned by some sort of slave supported system or some sort of segregational system. But in understanding migration, you have to understand that unless everybody was a baby, people came with their experiences, and even upon entering or finding themselves here, no matter how violent their welcome might have been and how under how much threat they might have been under, to forget or to minimize or to eschew those experiences, it doesn't go away. So one of those things that we've been able to see over time is that people came here with their own understanding of their spirituality, their religiosity.
Their
religion, and have left clues, have left remnants. The remnants are present in our modern day churches. They're present in some of our rituals. And we just want to do an overview and see what that looks like.
One of the powerful images that I see of this. There's a show on Starz called American Gods, and the concept of the show is basically when people came to America, most of them immigrants, not all, because slaves were also brought. Mm-hmm. They brought their gods with them. Mm-hmm. And so in the second episode of season one, there's a very powerful piece by Orlando Jones, who is playing the character of a Nazi, the spider, in Yoruba tradition, mm-hmm. or Yoruba spirituality. Mm-hmm. And he's talking to the slaves on a ship during the Middle Passage. And it is such, I mean, it's on YouTube. He crushes this. But wow. What the point of that piece was, those slaves are bringing that God with them. And that's what happened when slaves were brought over here. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we see is the continuation of those customs or those practices, maybe in a bit of a different guise. Mm-hmm. Du Bois puts it, he says, Africans stolen from the homeland and brought across the Atlantic as human cargo, and who brought their religion with them. The Black church served as the sole surviving institution of the African fatherland. The Black church during this time was the first African church. This is where they continued to practice their customs. Mm-hmm. Now, that was later attempted to be suppressed, as with everything else we see in Alex Haley's Roots, where names were stripped away and mm-hmm. things like that. But when they first arrived, they arrived with everything that
they had,
who they were.
Exactly.
And so that's their names, their culture, their religion, their mm-hmm. all of that stuff. This is the foundation of the Black American church. Mm-hmm. The slaves, they weren't allowed to integrate the experience of their ancestors alive, so they had to figure out different ways to do this using their current reality, and any memory that they had to try to make sense of it. So they didn't have the connection to the people in Africa, mm-hmm. or the cultures and everything in Africa. And that means that you don't have, like, if you think about your family now, you don't have your parents who you can ask questions,
right.
of, your grandparents who, like, you may be doing some
right.
some research and you want to say who was this, or they were related to them or whatever. Mm-hmm. We lost all of that. So that becomes a loss of a way to make sense of your current situation. Mm-hmm. As you're in this, you're thrust into this traumatic situation now. You don't know how such and such handled, you know, whatever. It wouldn't have been American Chattel Slavery, but it would have been, you know, this ancestor was resilient in this mm-hmm. way. And so the slaves really had a tough time adjusting, and their faith is kind of one of the things that kind of brought them some stability in terms of understanding the present conditions, the then present conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what ended up happening is the culture that they had, or the spirituality that they had, those practices were transposed over Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is how you get religions like Santeria and things like that, mm-hmm. where the slaves and the Caribbean slaves were forced into Catholicism, but they know that right. we have orishas,
right.
and so
they superimpose
so
that.
They like, oh, you got saints? Well, we have orishas, and so let's call. Okay, you want us to call it by that name, but we know that that name is really this orisha, and so you have this Africanized version of Catholicism, and now it's othered as this other thing, but it's really just Africans trying to make, you're forcing us to take this thing, but we have to take it in a way that we understand
mm-hmm.
because we're not letting go of who
of
we
that
are. And so we see that in the Black American church. So one of the things that we learn in the seminary is how much of the African faith was retained in the early Black churches,
okay,
during slavery. And the things that we see now are direct results of intentional efforts to make sure that we retain the culture. So, for instance, there's a Congo cosmogram, and it basically maps the rotation or the pattern of the sun.
Okay.
Okay, and this is big in African spirituality. It shows different, it's like four quadrants in a circle, counterclockwise. So this was integral to their belief system. And so to retain that, the African slaves would dance in a way that, so like if you think about like crip walking in LA,
mm-hmm.
like it's not just dancing. Like it initially started with them dancing, but spelling out
right.
the streets or the sets mm-hmm. that they're from. So Great Street Crips, the now I can't show you because it's a podcast, but the first step of a Great Street Crip would be a circular, like a counterclockwise circular, to draw out the G on the ground. Then you draw out the R, then the A, then the P, and that's how they dance, and that denoted where they're from. The slaves did this with this Congo cosmogram. So the cosmogram shows the counterclockwise position of the positioning of the sun. And if you look at early Black Christians, or just in modern Christians, like shouting, a lot of times it would be like, for people who watch shout videos all the time on YouTube, like, you would see this is a holdover from what earlier slaves did. They would shout in this pattern. So it's a counterclockwise circle. And so you see people shouting and they kind of buck in a circle, and they may not know, you know, where this is coming from. But originally right. this comes from them trying to retain, you know, where they're from, just like a Crip would do or a Blood would do through the day.
I just think that's amazing, but go ahead.
It's a brilliant way to interject your culture into a faith that is not yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so we mentioned last episode with the call and response and the percussive elements of music
right.
and things like that. All of that is holdover from Africa, and the Black church, the early Black church, was used as a vehicle for bringing forward those African customs
mm-hmm.
and retaining them. And so now we do a lot of this stuff today and don't really realize that this is what it's from, or this is the connection.
Right.
But it was intentional.
This is it. Yep. Okay, so that's the bridge that was built. We talk a lot about Christianity because we understand that to be the predominant religious force in America from the time of arrival through now. But if you understand anything about African migration, then you know that Islam was present in a lot of the source areas for people who ended up coming to America. So Islam
mm-hmm.
actually has manifested in our culture and in our understanding of religion in America. And it's not always amplified. It's not talked about. Now it's being scapegoated for certain things, but it's been present, you know, even in the recent weeks, people have spoken of Thomas Jefferson's Quran, yes. Which means, so if Jefferson was president during the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, then he had a Quran at the turn of the 19th century. So this is not about a Muslim ban, travel ban in 2018, 2019. This is about the fact, you know, that some of the imagery and some of the symbolism that I think we've accorded to other traditions is actually rooted in this other faith tradition that is strong within our community. So this is, we did not get into Islam with Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X.
Yeah, that's the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, and it's not even the same thing, which is what I was going to say. But this is not the beginning of those acknowledgments. The beginning of those acknowledgments is actually the importation of people who might have had that type of religious adherence, which would have been acknowledged and could have been a point of resistance in what they were willing and not willing to do. You know, even if it looked like they were willing to do everything, you do have examples of people not eating certain foods because of their true religious rooting. Mm-hmm. You have examples of, even with scraps, even with not given much to wear or much to do anything for yourself personally, you have people who always honored hair covering because that is what they were used to culturally. We're not talking about people who said, cover your hair because I'm jealous. We're talking about people who always found a way to cover themselves because of an acknowledgement or an adherence. Like you say, they might not have known where it came from because of broken chains to their true rooting. But even privately naming children in Arabic, mm-hmm. is something that you wonder how certain names came into the vernacular, is because people still retain something personal for themselves, even if it wasn't acknowledged or confirmed by this, you know, greater society.
Yeah, so no one really knows when Islam touched the shores of America. Mm-hmm. But the things that we do know is that in Christopher Columbus's journal, there's a mention of a mosque that he saw on top of a hill, and he had wanted to build something else, which indicates that there were Muslims in America, mm-hmm. prior to Christopher Columbus. And it's commonly believed, again, it's not unanimous, but it's commonly believed that the first Muslims in America were exiled Moors from Spain. And this was around the 14th century. So it's around 1300.
That actually makes sense.
Yeah, so they came over as sailors. They weren't slaves when they got here. They just didn't have any place to go.
Because the Portuguese were not sailors until the Moors were finished with them.
Right, so they came over. And then there's one scholar, his name is Tayyip. Tayyip Erdogan, mm-hmm. who kind of, he dates it at 1178. So there's some dispute around when it happens, but we are relatively sure that this was prior to Christopher Columbus. Mm-hmm. So the Moors are black Muslims. So this is well before the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, well before.
W.D. Fard starts with his creation story in that movement. So Muslims continue to thrive in America today. Mm-hmm. I need to be clear. When we say black Muslims, we just can't. The image of the Nation of Islam is so
prominent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not just, they're black Muslims all over that are not members of the Nation of Islam.
Oh, yeah. And by no means are we insinuating that.
No. So there's different beliefs. I'm not saying, you know, one's bad, one's not. I just want to say they're different, mm-hmm. in terms of what they believe. They follow the Quran, but they're different. They have different origin stories. They have different creation accounts. They have different views of God. And so when I'm talking about black Muslims, I guess I'm talking about both, but really I'm not talking about the Nation of Islam.
Okay.
Because the Moors were not Nation of Islam. Okay, so another interesting thing about the black Muslims is that they also exist, like everything else, is not a monolith. They exist in different communities. Mm-hmm. You got black Muslims from West Africa. You have black Muslims from Caribbean, Arab Muslims who are black. And they are in their own communities. Mm-hmm. They are, especially like in New York, this is very segregated. And they have a bit of a bit of attention there. But the cool thing about the early Moors that came to America is they had an advantage in that they were multilingual. So they had Arabic and they had whatever languages they spoke or chose to speak over here or from whatever countries they were from. And that also served as a means to further their education. So them reading the Quran in both Arabic and whatever other languages bolstered the education. Just like in the black Christian slaves, their education was enhanced because they weren't allowed to speak in white churches. So right. They had to be cloistered off into their black churches. But the white people weren't coming to speak at the black churches. That meant someone black had to speak at the black church. And if they're speaking from the Bible, they have to be able to read. Mm-hmm. And so that became an avenue towards education, the person who led the services in the black church. And this works similarly in mosques for black Muslims, except they're reading two languages. Mm. So this worked to their advantage as they began to own land and property and things like that. So black Muslims have been here and they've been thriving for a while. Okay, so modern church culture. Huh. Actually, I just want to talk about not all black church culture because we do that a lot on the show. Mm-hmm. Black megachurch culture.
Okay.
Electronic church culture. Ways that you get your church on the internet and things like that. I quoted Du Bois earlier. He also said, the black preacher is the most unique personality developed by the Negro on American soil. A teacher, a leader, a politician, an orator, a boss, an intriguer, an idealist. This is something that was developed in the black community and then exported. The charisma and all of that comes from that person. Mm-hmm. This person was empowered to do things that other blacks were not able to do.
Right.
And so the black preacher became this elevated figure in the black community and looked to as that leader and that force, that politician, to help move the community forward and mm-hmm. speak on the community's behalf. Mm-hmm. So there's a writer named Jonathan Walton that kind of summed up this. He calls it electronic church in three overarching characteristics. So this is, the church is personality driven, which means that charismatic leader is the force that propels the church. It is crowd dependent, meaning that this crowd is what finances and supports this. So that leader can be as charismatic as he or she wants, but without that crowd dependency, that sourcing, nothing happens. And then there's this entertainment aspect. It's an entertaining place. Now, if black church is an entertaining place, because if you've gone to a non-black church, maybe you were not as entertained.
Yeah, true.
it's part of it. I mean,
true. I was sitting here saying, okay, so this is both a gift and a curse. I think we've been critical of some of these things, mm-hmm. but they do have their purpose.
Well, think about it from the perspective of, like, historically, like, you didn't really, if you're working in a field and you don't have any opportunities for any place to let your head down, the church becomes the place to do mm-hmm. that. And so it's not the only place, because you also have your shack in the back of the woods where y'all, you know, your moonshine and all that stuff. But in the black church, there is an entertainment element that's always been there because we're free. Mm-hmm. And this is just what it's like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, issue there, though, with the black mega church culture or this electronic church culture, people tend to come and want these clear cut answers to things. And so they request or demand of that personality figure to feed them answers in ways that they can digest. Mm-hmm. And then they go, they're entertained, and then they go away, and then they come back the next week and do the same thing.
Yep.
Which almost works to anti-intellectualize what we're doing.
I feel like we're already there. I feel like we're already there. Where, so like I said, it's a gift and a curse, because if you're, I could see if as the church is growing, of course, you want to benefit from the personality and being able to enlarge your territory. You have more congregants and you can do things that you couldn't do when you were a ministry only serving 100. Now you're a ministry serving 1,000. You go, you keep growing. But I think we have seen some examples of this particular model kind of just growing out of control. There are people that we have acknowledged, because I don't want to use this episode to tear people down, but you know, we've seen some people and their personalities have outgrown the building, or have outgrown, I don't want to say the trappings of the ministry, but it's like their personal life is bigger than their ministry. And I'm not sure that it's that it should be that way. When you get to that point where your life outside of your title, outside of your life in the pulpit, where it's starting to compete, that's a point of contention. And we've seen it, but I also think that, much like what we described in our previous episode just about We Love Us, here is something else, another part of our culture that is has become worthy of export. So people are tuning in to electronic church, and they are picking up things that they didn't have to do the heavy lifting for. You know, once upon a time, you had to come to our church to understand how our churches run. You know, so now you don't have to do that. You can hop on YouTube and see our choir, see our sermons, see our praise breaks even. You can log into the actual church's website and watch whatever you want. So it's a different type of community powered by these platforms, but I also think that it's susceptible to, the first word that came to my mind is poaching, meaning you don't have to be there, you don't have to collaborate, you don't have to learn directly from, you can just mimic.
And it's also, as a community, it is an odd space, because as you grow to that size, it is easy to get lost. I mean, I've experienced that, where I started with a smaller church, and as that church grew in size, like, I'm like, who are these people? They don't know me. And it's easy for me to come and go without ever speaking to anyone and having a meaningful conversation. So I'm not having really any mental exercise being put to what's being taught. And I'm also not engaging that with the people around me. And so it lends itself to a level of anonymity that I think that we should deal with at some point.
So some churches are dealing with it well, because just like you say, that traditionally, historically, the person, most likely the man who became this black preacher and this leader within community, had or leveraged more opportunity for education, exposure, refinement, whatever it might be. Now you have within these mega churches the spawning of ministries that is making use of the human capital in the church. So it's like what comes first, the chicken or the egg? So it's like, now I'll create something for you to do because I now know that you know how to do it. You see what I mean? So like, for the capital that goes through the church every Sunday or throughout the week, whatever, now I can create ministries for you to use your gifts and for you to use your training, which minimizes that anonymity and brings you into, I think, a larger organizational network, that is not just about, you know, me sermonizing and you accepting that sermon. Now it's about the women's ministry, the men's ministry, the children's church. It's about the choir. And no longer is the choir based on interest, it's based on talent. We having full on auditions. You know, the musician corps is not just, you know, such and such son who always playing the drums. Yeah. You know, it's like professional musicians who are sharing their talent, their time and their talent and their professionalism with the organization. So some places are probably, I mean, I'm thinking they're doing their best to manage that growth, because it's just like growing a business. Yeah. You know, you can sometimes it's about having the capacity, and then sometimes you realize, wow, I've overwhelmed the structure that I already have.
Yeah, it does.
And I need to catch up.
I remember working for a small company, and we all knew each other, and we did good, and Christmas bonuses were great and all that stuff. And then as the company grew, that stuff kind of went away. And so there's a cost and a benefit to that. So you lose some of the home feel, the down feel of that small company or that small church. And then that company is also able to do other things. So maybe I don't get the huge Christmas bonus, but now I'm looking at my salary now compared to what it was, and that's the bonus that just is there all the time. So like, there are definitely benefits to growing in size. And then there's also benefits to not even being that size, to being that small church, because you do have that that intimate interaction with the members. You mm-hmm. know who they are, you know. And then that has its drawbacks too, because when it's time for you to do something that you may want to do, you might not be resourced to do that.
Right.
So yeah, so Black church is still growing, and there's not a one size fits all approach on this Mm-mm. one. But you know, some people prefer the small ones, some people prefer the mega churches, you know.
Right. For reasons that they probably think that they can really tap into, you know, and just understand, like, oh, I just like smaller congregations, or I like the family style mm-hmm. church feel, or I like all of the resources that a mega church might offer me. The whole entire landscape shows the usefulness for the various sizes of these ministries, because small churches, like you said, have an agility that maybe a larger mega church doesn't have. They have their appeal to various audiences, but I feel like each one needs the other to really maximize their impact in the overall community. And it's not for nothing that when you say, because this is an overview of Black faith in America, most of our most notable attempts at revolution and revolt were led by these charismatic church leaders, mm-hmm. these preachers who were beginning to not only profess a faith, but they were also turning those words inside out. And they were tapping into not just what was in the Bible, but what was also in the community overall. So you don't have Emmanuel AME Church, which was founded by a man who wanted to lead revolt. And at the last moment, it was thwarted mm-hmm. by fear. We don't have the fear that Nat Turner struck in the heart of Central Virginia, without him first being this orator who was able to whip people up and give them a vision of their own freedom. But these are the things. I mean, their legend persists. So it goes hand in hand. Even a Dr. King, who is probably tired of us saying his name, but when you really get into his true thoughts about what exactly is this movement that I've become the face of, mm-hmm. when he began the deeper self-reflections, not just the meetings and using the church as the heart of the community, which is what it was because it was what we had for ourselves. But when he really began to consider what am I actually asking for? What is it that I want this end game to be? When that conversation turned toward economics and turned toward self-sufficiency, his days were numbered. I mean, I don't know how else to say that, because that was him tapping into revolt mm-hmm. as opposed to any reconciliation, integration, getting along. You start talking about the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, okay. I feel like that was we missed our show on
MLK. We did. We have to come back.
We had a really good show on Martin Luther King. But we'll come back to it.
We will.
Okay, so another face of Black faith in America is African spirituality. Mm-hmm. Okay, now this is not what we discussed before, where you have the subversive version of it inserted into another faith. This is overtly practicing yes. African spirituality. There's been a rise in, I mean, so this has always been there like everything else, mm-hmm. particularly because slavery was a huge recruiting tool for African spirituality, meaning as slaves were introduced to these Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. Religions, and even Islam to a certain extent, it didn't match up with what was going on or how they were being treated. And so they were like, no, we don't want that faith. Mm-hmm. We got a faith already mm-hmm. and it's awesome and it works for us.
Yep.
And so as long as Black people have been here, African spirituality has been part of the fabric.
Yep.
So now you're seeing a movement towards interest in African spirituality or
interest in reclamation of yep. it.
Mm-hmm. And that's fair, because the same critique that the slaves had, like, this is not really working for us, this is not helping for us, as we see Christian brothers and sisters going into a voting booth and voting against something that would be our best interest or something that would help us. We're like, wait a minute, you believe the same thing we believe? I don't think so.
Right. So I can't tell.
I don't trust it. So right. You're seeing this, and then even through like some pop culture references, like so you see in Beyonce's Lemonade where she comes in as Oshun, and it's a beautiful scene with what song is that?
Yeah, hold up.
Yeah, so she comes in, the door's open, she's dressed
and
like a...
people went crazy. Yes. They went crazy about it and were so excited to see someone at her level fully embracing, you know. I think that creatives go through cycles and phases, but she definitely put a lot of imagery of African spirituality all throughout the visual album for Lemonade, the visual depiction of Lemonade. And it was, I think it, because it's not about her. However, I think that seeing it presented so artistically and I want to say non-threatening way, it's almost like she disarmed people, you know, with it, the fact that it was her and her beauty. But that message resonated globally with African rooted people because they saw their gods represented in what she was doing, their iteration of what they believed that their god bodies could do in that reflection of her work.
Lemonade is crazy rich with African spirituality.
It is.
I
mean,
I can't remember all the names of the songs now. I'm a suck, so people won't get
it. I got
but
you.
But it's dope because, and hold up, like they're in the city. Like, and she enters as Oshun, this Orisha, with the water coming down the stairs and all that stuff. And then she's playful, just as this Orisha is, while she's doing something very,
very destructive, just as she was.
But then they go into this bus where these it's black and white, and, and people have the African paint on, and then that bus is gone out to it's in the wilderness, and so it represents this journey away from the city life into a natural environment with all of this African imagery, and then she has this experience out there, and then she brings that back to the city. And so like these type of images are healing to people who identify with that, even if they don't know why. They're just like, yes, that's what it should feel like.
Yes.
That feels like the right thing. And so when something like that resonates, people start to move forward. And we're talking Yoruba traditions like Ifa, Santeria, Voodoo, which are things that have been othered over time because there was an attempt to remove the African culture from the African during slavery. And so that has never like completely been undone. And so now there's a conscious effort to actually look at that and say, hold on, wait a minute. This is not the negative thing that you've been telling me. This actually feels like it fits more than maybe this other thing. And I'm gonna tell you one of the ways that I really felt this, and I mean, my mother transitioned recently, but even before this, I had started having this idea that the Christian ideas or the way we process death is insufficient for me. It's insufficient because you're basically saying this person has died and they've gone to be with the Lord, and their only real interaction with you is in an intercessory role through God. So maybe that person is looking at what's going on, and then they're praying to God to actually intervene on your behalf, which puts them at least 2 degrees away from you. Whereas in an African tradition or Yoruba tradition, that person as an ancestor is there present with you. And you see this, let's say for instance in Black Panther, in the scene where he goes to speak, where T'Challa goes to speak with his father, and it's among all these African ancestors.
Right.
And that resonates with me. Like, that makes more sense than having this person that you're never, that's why like phrases like give them their flowers while they can still smell them, it puts the person off in another world that you'll never come in contact with, you never should meet until you're off in that other world. And that just leaves a void while you're here, and it's difficult to process grief. So when like a couple days after my mom had transitioned, My kids were in the car, and they're still dealing with this and trying to understand, and because they've lost their grandmother. Mm-hmm. And so my son says, you know, grandma's an ancestor now. And I was like, yes.
Awesome.
Yes.
Yes.
That's exactly
that's
it.
That's awesome.
Because an ancestor is something that's with you. There's reverence yeah. for your ancestor. There's interaction with your ancestor. There's a nearness that comes with that. And mm-hmm. so anyway, African spirituality becomes this thing that people start to discover and like, wait, this actually works.
I think that even so we talk about the things, the natural lines that were broken intentionally. And when you reclaim people back as an ancestor, that's reclamation. That means that you are no longer nameless and faceless and without a country and without a family, without a home. You belong to me. And not only do you belong to me, but now I can embody whatever it is that I think were your highest ideals. The highest vision that I have of you is something that it can continue to live. Not that funerals are meant to be fun, but one funerary tradition that I find myself admiring is what they do in New Orleans
with the lines
and the celebration.
Yes.
Celebrating you in your transition. Believe it or not, that is rooted in deep African tradition. We have examples of that in Egypt where, you know, why were people busting in tombs? Because you would literally outfit a tomb, especially a king's tomb or some higher level of society. You would outfit their tomb with everything that you thought they would need to transition from this life to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't assume that they could just get there. You would put a chariot in there. You wouldn't assume that they would eat there. You would put food there. You wouldn't assume that they could fashion their hair or make up their face or any of the day-to-day mundane things. You would put those things there. So this idea of celebrating somebody, now I'm going to, even when you talk about shouting, people be talking about I'm shouting heaven down, right? I'm going to make God, you know, talk to me. I'm going to make him come back to me. It's the same thing. You know, at my aunt's funeral, I had never been to a funeral like this, but I'm telling you, it stands out in my mind. So my aunt was very African centered. She was the first person to celebrate Kwanzaa with me. The first person to invite me to celebrate Kwanzaa. She was the first person. Every time she came over our house, she always came with some sort of instrument, doing something, hand clap, tambourines, drums, anything. She was awesome. She wrote poetry. Long story short, when she passed away a few years ago from breast cancer, when I walked into the church, when I tell you, the women were dancing and calling and making that high pitched like sound. They were, I mean, dancing. Watching her daughter and her son dance. And she pretty much was always their number one supporter. But I had never, ever, ever seen the celebration of so much Africanness inside the church during the transitioning of someone's soul. So just looking at that, I probably had the emotional reaction that I had to that, how powerful it was, because I found myself saying to myself, oh my gosh, she taught me how to love myself. Mm-hmm. But it was even the love that was shown to us even after she planned the whole thing, mm-hmm. but she was like, it's important to me that you dance. It's important to me that you sing. It's important to me that you do these things. And that centered it for me, but it also brought home for me all that she had tried to teach me. Mm-hmm. In the beginning. So that made it more peaceful. That made it more digestible. Because yeah. you're still going to deal with a grief process. But sometimes that funeral snapshot, depending on what's going on, that can really sit with you. But if you find a place to celebrate all that it was, because I don't like when a person lived a vibrant life and then everything's very... Yeah. black and white, you know, at the end. But this idea of celebrating, that resonates with me because or just even resonates with this idea of it, of African spirituality. Because I'm like, yo, weren't we celebratory if we was like, yo, you made it out the trap. Like, you don't have to live this life anymore. You don't have to live this downtrodden life. And it's the same thing. Like, it might not seem formal, but maybe other people do it, but I don't be with them. After those types of acknowledgments, how the family comes back together. Like, yeah, it's a repast, but then there's like the repast after the repast. Mm-hmm. That's for the close friends and family that is not as formal as that first one, where the stories are being told and the music is playing and people are able to have their little side conversations and check in on folks and the mini family reunion that takes place. Mm-hmm. I feel like all of that is a part of it, of what, you know what I'm saying?
I didn't think of it until you just mentioned it, that connection to Egypt and New Orleans. New Orleans is one of my favorite cities to visit. One of the reasons why is because when I leave the airport, I have to pass the cemetery. Mm-hmm. And the cemetery is only mausoleums. And I don't know if they just have different pricing than we have, because we have like tombstones up here, and the most impressive version of a cemetery up here is like Arlington National Cemetery. Mm-hmm, with all mm-hmm. that precision. But to see all of those mausoleums like a pyramid in Egypt, mm-hmm. where they allow you to, you know, put all your stuff and yep. all that. I mean, that's
they have different land than we have.
Yeah, so they have to. So it's a flooding
you
thing,
have to do it.
Yeah,
but
I'm telling you, the price of a mausoleum up here, there's no way they charge.
But that's
the same
integral
thing
to their culture. Yeah. But again, we acknowledge that Southern Louisiana is one of the most Africanized places mm-hmm. that you will still find in the United States. And it just, I don't know. It is everybody should go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody should go, but there's nothing like seeing what happened. I almost feel like the African presence in that area of the country was constant, even as other things changed around it. So the one thing that the three superpowers could decide, you know, actually agreed on, was that Africans were going to be integral to the growth of that area. Mm-hmm. But by doing that, regardless of whether they were speaking French, speaking Spanish, or ultimately speaking English, is that it's like having it's like taking a thumbprint. The thumbprint doesn't change. My thumbprint will not change, even the, you know, from the time I'm a baby to the time I get up out of here. But that's what that area is like. So when you talk about retaining this African spirituality, it shows up there in so many different ways, and it's being obscured as New Orleans culture. Yeah, that ain't not all them. That's us.
So we are south of the Mason-Dixon line, and so we see an English colonial culture mm-hmm. that is a French colonial culture that is enriched with blackness, and then you have those African elements of Yoruba traditions there yep. with voodoo and things like that, and all of that is part of the culture.
All of it, because that's who their trading partners were. Like, this is not like somebody sat back and like made some elaborate scheme. It was easier to sail to Cuba, to Havana in particular, that never really stopped importing slaves. So you always had this new iteration of this Africanness, and the music, and even the acknowledgement of these gods mm-hmm. is something that traveled that same trade route. It traveled the same route to what became Haiti. So we're just talking about economics and history. We're not talking about somebody who was like, oh my God, this is how we want it to be.
But I love how the God stayed. Another reason that African spirituality is an important perspective to consider mm-hmm. is because of the affirmation of black women in many of these traditions. Mm-hmm. So we talked about Beyonce as Oshonet's one of the Orishas. There's others, Aja and Emoja and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. even in their creation story, so we, a lot of times in Christian creation story, we talk about God and it's he, even though that's not really the limit of the language that's in the scriptures, but that's mm-hmm. just what we've been conditioned to do. In African traditions, you're not obliged to do that. So in their creation stories, mm-hmm. when you're talking about Oludemare and Olorun, these are the creation forces. And let's say we're talking about a story where Oludemare, she mm-hmm. wanted to create but she kept pouring out this water out of her pot, and the water was so hot that every time she tried to create a universe, it didn't work. And so she kept trying and it didn't work. So one day she, Oladumare, had her daughter bring her pot, and her pot was the cooling pot. And this is incorporating all like nature and clay and water and stuff like that. And Oladumare pours her pot into Olaroon's pot, and Olaroon's pot pours into the universe and creates the universe. And so now you have these two feminine deities energies. Creating everything. And then the Orishas help govern and protect this world. So you have Yemojo, the mother goddess. You have Aja, nature or healing herbs. And you have a different Orisha for each thing. And it's this mix of genders and affirmations of different people and things and stuff. And it's a beautiful, and so, and then you see a lot of Ifa, Santeria practitioners, a lot of them are women, and they don't have the same ceilings that we have in some of the other faiths, in Abrahamic faiths, where women aren't allowed to do things.
Right.
And so that is an attractive proposition. Like, well, I can, this fits for me, and no one's telling me because I'm a woman and I can't do this. Mm-hmm. All right. So the last thing we want to touch on real quick before we get out of here is, non-religious faith. These are our agnostic, atheist brothers and sisters that also exist in America. This is faith. It may not be a faith in a religious sense, but faith is the belief.
Right.
So even if, let's say, you're agnostic and you believe, you know, maybe there's a God, I don't know. That's still, you're hoping, right. You got some faith that you believe in the
perhaps.
Right thing. This has always existed in America. As we said, you know, slavery led to all types of beliefs. Yeah. Like,
taking away choice means that you took away people's choice to not have to participate in certain things as well.
Yeah, so slavery, again, led a lot of people down this path. Reconstruction gave them hope that maybe God is looking out for us. Because at first it's like, God doesn't care. If there's a God, why would God do this? And then Reconstruction is like, well, maybe. And then Reconstruction fails. Oh, that's what I thought. And so then you move on to
the
Harlem Renaissance. And then you start to have a lot of black thinkers arising.
People are
being educated. And then you got your Langston Hughes and your Richard Wright and your Zora Neale Hurston's. And these are people who don't identify with any particular religion. But whereas some people are congregating in their churches and having that experience, they're maybe in a parlor having their experience
and
their
discussion.
And they're trying to figure out how to make things better. They're trying to figure out how to improve the quality of life for people on earth right now. And so that's where you see these people who have been with us, working with us. Now, if you go to the civil rights movement and you start to see people like Stokely Carmichael and Eldridge Cleaver, also not religious, also more leaning agnostic, also walking with Dr. King, who is a Christian, and Jews and other peoples of a different faith to help improve life in this country. Like, these are people who are us. They are part of our community. They are respected like anyone else, and they have always been there. And so this was just a brief synopsis
of some of the stuff
because we got a lot.
There's so much here. We didn't even talk about black Jews, but okay.
No, we didn't. So, I guess this is going to be a series.
we have a lot. We have some things to come back and cover. But the point is, and like we said at the top of the show, it's a puzzle, and we wanted to define some of the pieces. So now you see that we have a piece that is rooted in, what has happened here in Christianity. We have a piece that is rooted in the fact that you have the appearance of black Muslims here. You know, we have a piece that is filled by people who don't necessarily have a faith or an acknowledgement.
Their faith is in us that we can be better.
Right. So we've covered some things, but we've left some things for part two, I guess. Da, 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 da.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.